only one who has words of life. Preachers have lots and lots of words, and all of us do. But you're the only one who has words of life. So we invite you to be the one who will teach all the way through this session on Hosea, and also on why I believe. But especially this morning, would you just take captive each one of our thoughts and bring us into touch with yourself. Make the book live to us, but much, much more important than that, draw us into much deeper relationship with yourself, the kind of relationship that you want to have with us, and the kind of relationship which we really hunger for in our hearts, although very often not recognizing that it's really you that we are hungry for. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, as Bill said, he wasn't sure how I was going to divide up the subjects, and I'm not sure either, except in the evenings we'll have, since I have both lectures each evening, we'll have one on each. Okay. And then it gives me time to think about it before I have to continue on the same theme. So this morning we're going to look at Hosea, but we need to do a background study to introduce that. So that's what I aim to do. And we just need an Old Testament survey, which we have a few minutes to accomplish. So, and I'll give you time to get used to my strange voice. You'll discover I don't like shouting at people. I do it when it's necessary, but I don't enjoy it much. So I'll just talk. If you have difficulty hearing, by all means, ask for a repetition. Or you can ask your technician to turn the sound up a little further or whatever. It sounds kind of loud to me. But is anybody having trouble hearing? Okay. So in the beginning, God created lots of things. And especially, he created man. And he created man for a number of reasons, but he created man in his own image. I want to take you back about 200 years in history, back to the time when I was a mere 17 years old. It's not quite 200 years, it just feels that way sometimes. And back then, when I was 17, I had a friend at school who had never, in the whole of his life, ever had a girlfriend or even so much as a date. His name was Graham, and he came to see me to see if I could help him to organize a date. And I wasn't sure that I could, but I said, just leave it with me, Graham, we'll do our best. And when I thought about the assignment, I remembered Pam. Pam being an extremely attractive girl who had just had a huge argument with her boyfriend, Brian. And it was such a serious argument that even though they had been dating for more than 6 months, they were no longer on speaking terms. So I went round to see Pam, and I invited her to come with me down to the fairground. And on the way down to the fairground, I said to her, Pam, you know Graham, don't you? And she said, Graham? What about Graham? Well, do you know, for instance, he's never had a date? No, she said, I'm sure he hasn't. I said, I know what you're telling me. You think he's weird. Actually, he's not weird. He's just shy. But he's so shy that when he gets around somebody, especially somebody like him, he behaves as though he's weird. But if you got to know him underneath all that shyness, he's really very nice. Is he? Mm-hmm. And what's that got to do with me? Well, consider it, Pam. You know those evenings you used to spend with Brian, don't you? Those long evenings. And she said, yeah. Well, you don't spend them with Brian now. And if you don't spend them with Brian, that means you must have all that time to spare. And if you've got all that time to spare, it wouldn't hurt you to spend one evening with Graham. Maybe it wouldn't hurt me, she said, but why should I? Well, consider it some more, Pam. Suppose you did, and you didn't tell anybody. And though you don't tell anybody at all, and nobody sees you, there's just himself and Graham, and Graham doesn't tell anyone either. Nevertheless, Brian learns about it by some amazing stretch of coincidence, like I tell him. He might think that he's in serious danger of losing you altogether, and that will be just the spur he needs to come round and ask you out himself. Hey, he said, that might work. We'll try that one. So I arranged with Pam that she'd be waiting on the steps of the town hall about 7:30 on the Saturday evening. And by this time we got down to the fairground and we had a wonderful time on the whirligigs and the roller coasters and all the other machines designed to make you sick and get money out of you at the same time. Very clever, really. And we were enjoying that until we found some of these mirrors with kind of wriggly glass in them. You know the kind, don't you? They make you look peculiar, don't they? Unless, of course, you look peculiar to begin with, in which case you might find one that was helpful to you. Pam was kind enough to stand beside the mirror while I took a photograph by pointing my camera into the mirror and taking the reflection. Then I took Pam home, went home myself, called Graham, told him he had a date for 7:30 on Saturday evening. Graham was excited. I then went to my room, took the film out of my camera and developed it, and it was magnificent. She had one eye up here and one eye down here and sort of lumps everywhere. And I took some scissors and trimmed around the photograph, took off the frame of the mirror and everything else, so it looked like a genuine photograph of a very unusual looking young woman. Saturday evening I went to Graham's home and he was getting ready for his very first date. And it was back in the era of the, well, in Britain were known as the Teddy Boys, and in America the Grease era, John Revolting and all that stuff. And guys in those days used to plaster their hair down with some white axle grease sold under the trade name of Brill Cream. You can see what it does for you long term. It's really not to be recommended. But anyway, Graham was doing this and getting all dolled up to go out on his very first date, and even went to the extraordinary lengths of cleaning his teeth, see, which made a wonderful difference to him. They were now white and not green as we were accustomed to seeing them. When at long last he was ready to go, I said to him, "You'll want to be able to recognize her, won't you?" "Yes," he said, "what's she like?" So I said, "I've got a photograph if you want to see it." And he took it from me all eagerly and looked at it, tried it the other way up. Then he went sort of pink and angry and he said, "What is that? Asked you for a girl, not a Martian. Where did you find that?" "Now look, Graham," I said, "so happens that Marilyn Monroe is busy tonight, but this girl is not. And she may look unusual to you, but she does have a lot of friends. And they all know she's having a date with you tonight, and it's important to her. So you must be there, and you must be there on time, and you must be very nice to her, otherwise her friends will be waiting for you on Monday." And muttering all kinds of horrible threats about what he would do to me on the Monday morning, Graham set off for his date with Pam. He arrived on the steps of the town hall at 25 minutes past 7, and he stood there looking very half-heartedly and very unenthusiastically for an approaching creature from Mars. Meanwhile, Pam was on the opposite side of the road watching Graham, enjoying herself and smiling gently. And he was very nervous and he kept checking his watch, and 7:30 came and there were no Martians, and 25 to 8 and the creature had still not arrived, and he decided that was long enough to wait and he was going to go home, and he set off down the steps ready to go home, and Pam came across the street and timed her arrival to meet him at the bottom of the steps, smiled nicely at him and said, "Hello, Graham, I'm Pam." And she really was very attractive. And Graham's eyes opened. And his mouth fell open. It's a good thing he had cleaned his teeth. And then he said, can't be. And she said, really, why can't I be? She said, well, you're nice. Well, of course I'm nice. What did you expect, a Martian or something? And while he was trying to figure out a way to talk his way out of this one, Pam started laughing at him, and she said, Ken didn't give you a photograph, did he? And he said, man, did he give me a photograph. I am going to destroy that character. And I'm telling this rubbish for this reason. There is somebody very, very brilliant, very original, very inventive, who is in the business of giving to you not a photograph, but a very ugly, very distorted mental picture of the most important person in your existence, and that's God. And he keeps on trying to feed you a very ugly, distorted picture, because he doesn't want you to know what God is really like. Because if you know what God is really like, then you will love him and you will serve him and you will obey him. He doesn't want you to do that. So he'll keep on trying to feed you a very distorted picture. And he began in the Garden of Eden with a lady who should have known lots better, and who did, but forgot what she knew. And he fed to her this idea. God is extremely boring, and he's just power crazy, and he wants to manipulate your life. If you continue to be obedient to him, you will always be bored. Life will never be fun. It will never be adventurous. It will never be exciting. And you will never be a real person. Not until you forget him, assert yourself, do your own thing, and then you'll be a real person. In fact, then you'll be like he is, knowing good and evil. And you'll be able to live entirely independently of him, and he doesn't want you to know that, because he's trying to keep the truth from you. He has threatened you and told you that you'll die if you do it. You won't die. Because not only is he boring, he's a liar. And Eve fell for the whole line. And she seriously believed that she would only become a real person if she disobeyed God and broke her relationship. And she seriously believed that what God had said would happen would not happen. And on that basis, she chose to disobey. And she had had a good understanding of what God is really like. And this was all brought about in the idyllic surroundings of the Garden of Eden, where there were trees everywhere, but one tree became absolutely irresistible. It was no better than all the other trees. And God had created all the trees, and the enemy had created nothing, because he can't. And he had nothing to offer. But what he succeeded in doing was making her forget all the other things that God had created, all the love and generosity and the character of God, make her focus on one tree that now she had to have, and forget the reality of her creation. And she disobeyed, and she fell. And her husband joined her. And the enemy is always at work to distort your picture of God, because that is where all the problems begin. When your picture of God is clear and true, you've no difficulty in obeying him and in loving him, because that's where he is. And every one of us has been created in order to have a relationship with him, and it is programmed into every one of us, and that is fundamentally what we want. But not only that, man was designed not only to know what God is like, but to show what God is like. In other words, he is created in the image of God. His whole life would give a true picture of God. When Adam and Eve disobeyed, they ceased to present a true picture of God. And they began to present a very distorted picture, and so did their whole family, including you and me. Now, you see, even if you have a perfect picture of God, if you had this morning a perfect picture of God, you will not have tomorrow. For two reasons. One is you have a memory which is not 100% accurate. Right? That is why some of you carry around with you, or plaster all over your walls, photographs of your dog at home, of course. or some other person who happens to be special to you. Why do you carry a photograph? Because your memory isn't all that good, right? If your memory was perfect, you wouldn't need a photograph, would you? It wouldn't do anything for you. You have a memory which fits. So even if you had a perfect picture of God now, tomorrow you wouldn't have, because you have a memory which isn't perfect. But in addition to that, you have an enemy who will distort the picture you have. Now, of course, you don't have a perfect picture of God this morning, because you never have had. You've always had an inadequate one. And the devil will always be at work to make sure it stays inadequate and indeed becomes more inadequate. And temptation will be aimed at distorting your picture of God and focusing your attention on something. It doesn't matter what it is. You'd be amazed at the things that people consider to be absolutely essential for their happiness. It's not. They think it is. That's what temptation does. It doesn't show you the long-term effect. When the devil tempted Eve, he didn't show her one of her sons murdering the other one. He didn't tell her that was in the package that she was opting for when she rebelled. Temptation never shows you the consequences of your action, only the desirability of the object. So, they sin. God has to do something about that. The rest of the Bible takes up with telling you what God's doing in order to put right what went wrong back then. And he is concerned, and he is always concerned, that we should, number one, know what he's really like, and number two, show what he's really like. And the human race continued for a little while, and it got worse and worse and worse until God decided there was a need to purify it and more or less destroy it. And so he sent a flood. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, and he landed high and dry. And the human race continues through Noah and through his family. And they were far from perfect, of course. But God has sort of... Can we see this? And that continues on to the guy Abraham. And Abraham is chosen out of the whole human race to be the father of a new nation. And that happens through his first son, what's his name? Isaac. And then through his what's his son? But he had his name changed to what? Israel. And through Israel, he chose the sons. How many sons? 11 plus Joseph. And out of these 11 plus Joseph, of course, is not one of the tribes listed, but he has two sons who are called, one's called Ephraim, what's the other one called? Manasseh, okay? Plus Ephraim plus Manasseh equals 13. And the next phase of history has to do with the 13 tribes of Israel. And he chose them in order that they would know him. And of course, they become slaves in Egypt for quite a period. And they're led out from there by the leader Moses. And God moves into the history of this nation in order to rescue them from Egypt. And it's a prolonged rescue act. And it takes place in the most cultured and most powerful nation in the earth at the time. The Egyptians were sophisticated in some areas. Sophisticated in writing. Sophisticated in many areas of learning. Rather primitive in medicine, as we'll see on another occasion. But in many areas of learning, very sophisticated. They had universities and well-developed university systems. They knew a lot about mathematics, and that enabled them to construct quite an effective navy and some interesting weaponry. Also, it enabled them to do some fairly adventurous building, which is probably the thing they're best remembered for, things like pyramids and sphinxes. And there is some really advanced building technique and mathematics involved in those constructions. And against this background, this enormously powerful and wealthy nation, you have a handful of slaves. Well, there are 3 million of them. But 3 million was a handful compared to the might of Egypt at that time. Just significant enough to be a little bit of a threat. If there were 3 million fifth columnists inside Egypt against a powerful enemy, it would be serious. And so they take steps to reduce the population by having all the male babies exterminated at birth. But Moses, of course, survives. And Moses leads the people out by a mighty series of miracles, the plagues of darkness and flies and frogs and the river Nile turned to blood, etc. The firstborn being killed. And then the big one, as they come out of Egypt and leaving Egypt, 3 million people setting off. They have no weapons. They've never learned how to fight. They've been slave people. 3 million, of course, includes women and children and people unsuitable for fighting, even if they had weapons and even if they had training and experience. And they see in front of them, all of a sudden, sparkling there in the distance, the shining waters of the Red Sea. They've never seen the ocean before. Because, of course, they never had a vacation. Slaves don't get too many. And there were no boats there, and there weren't any bridges across the ocean. It was just ocean, and they weren't able to swim because slaves generally aren't taught to swim either. And so here they were, the ocean in front of them. It sort of looks as though they're coming up to a dead end. There's no way across there, across the Red Sea. When they see behind them a sort of dust cloud, and it's the Egyptian army with Pharaoh himself at its head chasing after them. The greatest army in the world. And here they are caught between the Red Sea and this huge army. Led by Pharaoh, who as far as they're concerned is the devil himself. So here they are caught between the devil and the deep Red Sea. So it's kind of a nasty predicament to be in. But God opens the waters of the ocean. They go across. And he probably opened it by a length of about a mile. Otherwise, it would have taken them anything up to a week to get across there. They didn't go across in single file. Not 3 million. So it's a big opening. They go across. The army try to follow them. The waters return. They're all drowned. The next morning, they look back and the shore is littered with corpses. Thousands of bodies of soldiers and horses, wreckage of chariots, etc. And they see all that. And this is the dawn of a new day, and the ocean is between them and Egypt. And they have a great time. Moses got out his little soap box, and he stood on there, and he said, "Turn in your books to chorus number 361. Except he didn't, because they'd forgotten the organ and the piano, and they didn't even have a guitar amongst them. And they didn't even have a hymn book. There was a reason for that. They didn't have any hymns. There was even a reason for that. They'd never had anything to sing about before. Singing was absolutely unknown in their history, apparently, until then. But without Moses saying so, without anybody else saying so, 3 million people started singing. And they actually agreed on the words and the tune. Isn't that something? Now, why did 3 million people sing on this morning? They sang because there was inside a tremendous, overwhelming desire to praise the God who had kept all his promises and had set them free and had smashed the power of Egypt over them, and they really were liberated. And 3 million people sung, not because it was suggested to them, but because it was their inward desire to express their praise. Now let me ask you whether that is true of you. Is there within you a real desire to praise this great God who's doing things for you? That's how they were the day they came out. And it's one of the occasions I would love to have experienced. A choir of 3 million excited people must be quite something. And here they were having such a good time. Now, what had actually got them out of Egypt, in a way, was the lamb. The lamb that was killed, and they took the blood of the lamb and they applied it in the sign of a cross on the lintel and the doorposts of their homes. They didn't know they were making the sign of a cross. They just did what they were told with it. And, of course, it was looking forward to when the Lamb of God would come, dying upon the cross, and by his blood, we would be set free. Because the Old Testament is a kind of big screen, quadraphonic sound, brilliant color, living presentation of New Testament truth. There's virtually nothing in the New Testament that you can't find in the Old Testament. It's all there, spelt out years before it happened, centuries before it happened. And that picture of the lamb dying and them taking the blood and applying it, each family to themselves, is a picture of you and me trusting in Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God. And most of us here can look back to a day when we first realized what Jesus Christ had done for us. And when you first knew that he'd set you free. And you first knew that the guilt was gone and the hold of evil over your life was broken. And you were free from the first time in your life. And maybe you didn't sing out loud because you might be like me with a voice like a crow with laryngitis. So you didn't maybe sing out loud, but there was a great desire and joy in your heart to praise the Lord Jesus for what he'd done for you. Can you remember a time like that? But if we were to meet them 30 years later, we don't find them celebrating. We don't find them praising God. We find them grumbling. Why are they grumbling? Because it's what they were best at. And because they were bored. And it was boring in the desert. It was boring for three reasons at least. It was boring in the first place because they were not going anywhere. So they couldn't go back to Egypt because the ocean was in the way. And they couldn't go forward to Canaan, the promised land, because they'd been disobedient. So they weren't going. I didn't say they weren't moving. They were moving. They were moving in evangelical circles. Do you know any people who move in evangelical circles? Where do you get when you move in circles? Well, that's where they were getting. See? They weren't going in it. Do you mind if I ask you a question? Where are you going? I'm not talking about Corpus Christi for Easter or, you know, back home to mum and dad and to big steaks or something. But where are you going as a Christian? I'm not talking about heaven one day. I'm talking about now. Where are you going as a Christian? What are your objectives? In which directions are you growing? In which ways is God revealing himself to you? In which ways is he stretching your spiritual experience? What new capacities are you developing in order that you might serve him and grow up in him? You see, if you're not going anywhere, you're probably bored. Do you know what? You deserve to be. They were bored in the desert because they weren't going anywhere. They were just going around and around in circles. And a great majority of people who claim to be God's people in the West are doing just that. Where are we supposed to go to? The measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Did you get there yet? If you're not moving, you won't. That's why Paul says, I haven't made it yet, but forgetting what's behind me, I press toward the mark. He seems to have done fairly well up to now, but he's not got there yet. He's still making progress. why else was it boring in the desert? Because they weren't doing anything. Well, that's not quite true. Every morning they went out 6 days a week and collected manna. Probably took about 20 minutes. What else did they do? They put their tent, took their tents down and then put them up again. That was exciting, wasn't it? What else did they do? Not a lot. They didn't build in the desert because they weren't supposed to stay there. Didn't farm the desert. Didn't farm very well. Possibly they had sandcastle building competitions. That seems to be the thing to do in the desert. The terrain lends itself and you've got to fill up the 24 hours somehow. So they all managed to fill up 24 hours every day, just like you do. But what we do with that time that we've got, how do you fill up your 24 hours? What do you do with it? They organized bigger and better and more splendid and better publicized sandcastle building competitions. But they were bored because life is always boring when you try to play all the time. You weren't designed to play all the time. Play is great when it's in its place and you've done the work which merits the play. But play for an adult, if that's all you do, is boring. So they're bored because they're not doing anything. And let me ask you what you're doing as a Christian. And when you were back home before you came here, what were you doing as a Christian? Not did you find enough activities to fill up the time, but what was the end product? What did your Christian activity really achieve? What was it all for? Was it just to, you know, keep the cycle of meetings going? We've all got to turn up at least 4 or 5 times a week in order that we can say our numbers are at least maintaining their own and maybe even increasing. Maybe we've got a better building. But what's the real objective of doing it? What's the point of it? What are you achieving? Because if the answer to that is nothing, which in many cases it is, then you're probably bored and you deserve to be. Then it was also sort of boring in the desert because of the diet, which consisted of manna, which roughly translated means, what is it? Have you ever been served that? Have you ever sat down to a meal and looked at what was in front of you and said, what is it? If not, I'm sure we can arrange it for you before you leave. And here it was. And it was there. The first morning they collected like little snowflakes on the ground and they tasted like wafers stuck together with honey. You know, that's quite pleasant probably the first time. But after 30 years it was getting just a little bit monotonous. See, they had it for breakfast, they had it for lunch, they had it for supper and they had it for snacks in between. They had it roast, they had it fried, they had it grilled, they had it sunny side up and easy over and scrambled and every way they could think, but it still tasted kind of like manna. Now you imagine two teenagers meeting in the desert. An Israeli boy and a heathen boy from, let's say, Moab. And the two of them meet in the desert with that great formality with which teenagers meet. Hi, hi. Where are you from? I'm from Moab. Where are you from? Israel. Israel? Yeah. The people of God? Yeah. Hey, it must be great to be one of God's people. Yeah. I'd really like to see your lifestyle. You would? Yeah. Can I come visit you? Yeah, you can if you like. So where do you live? See that tent over there? What, that scruffy bit of goat hair on a pole? Yeah, I see that. Well, that's where I live. You live in that? Yeah. Why? Never thought about it, really. That's where I live. So, can I come visit you? Sure. Why don't you come after supper? Hey, that's not very nice. I thought you people were hospitable. Can't I come and have supper with you? Can if you want. delight manner.
Do I like what?
Exactly. No, seriously, what's manner? It's what we're having for supper. How do you know? Oh, I know. No, seriously, how do you know? You haven't been home to ask yet. We never have anything else. Hey, just a minute. I thought you had a great God. Oh, we do. What's he done for you? Set us free from Egypt. Boy. Must have been bad in Egypt. Oh, it was. Egypt was terrible. We used to have melons and onions and leeks and garlic. Oh, we don't have that now. God set us free from all that. We don't do that now. Now we have manna. So he set you free from Egypt. When was that then? 30 years ago. And 30 years, okay. And what's he done since?
What?
What has God done to you since he brought you out of Egypt 30 years ago? Isn't that enough? Well, it doesn't look like it. You know, what's he doing now? Well, he gives us manna. Yeah, but apart from that, don't know really. So God set you free from Egypt 30 years ago, and you sit, live in that tent, and you eat manna all the time. What do you do the rest of the day? Are those your sandcastles over there? Hey, yeah, do you like them? I'm our tribal champion. We've got this big, big contest coming up this weekend. Do you like them? Well, I quit playing sandcastles when I was 5 years old. Why are you doing that? Well, I tell you what, you come along at the weekend and help us with the sandcastle. You'll probably enjoy it, really you will. And maybe you'd like to become an Israeli. Would you like to become an Israeli? You must be joking. I thought my life was bad. It was terrible. And these people had absolutely no testimony. No challenge to the other people that made the other people envious of them with their relationship to God. The other people, the heathen, weren't flocking to join the Israelis when they wandered around in evangelical circles in the desert. They were a laughingstock. They were just an object of ridicule. And unfortunately, very unfortunately, that's what we've become. You listen to what the world is saying about us. And they were a rotten testimony. But they've been chosen by God to be his representatives. And he had given them three major advantages. Number one, rules. Number two, religion. And number three, riches. The rules were the Ten Commandments and the moral law. How do they help you to know God? Because they are the character of God spelt out in terms of human behavior. You study the laws and they will tell you what God is like. For instance, God is faithful. That is one of his characteristics. And the longer I live, the more I appreciate it. God is absolutely faithful. He never goes back on a promise. If God was a man, he would not break his promise to his wife. He would not be an adulterer. So the law says, you must not commit adultery. What's wrong with adultery when it's enjoyable? And I'm quite prepared to believe it is. What's wrong with adultery if everybody's doing it? Whoever everybody is. if it is very popular and very enjoyable, what's wrong with it? You know, if the United States government, the Canadian government, the British government, and the German government all agree that adultery is not a crime, what's wrong with it? Surely those guys must know something. It'd be nice to think they did, anyway. The thing that's wrong with it is just not like God. God isn't like that. And you and I were created to be in His image. And He doesn't change. Therefore His laws don't change. And what's right doesn't change. And what's wrong doesn't change. And no matter how popular it may become, and no matter how enjoyable it may be, it will never be right. And the laws tell you the character of God. When He has made a promise to you, He will keep that promise, even if it is over centuries, like the 400 years in which they waited in Egypt for Him to fulfill His promise to deliver them from there. Like the 2,000 years the world waited for Him to fulfill His promise that Jesus would come of the seed of Abraham. God always keeps His promises, never breaks them. Whatever He has said, He will do. And even if things look absolutely ridiculous, like Abraham, and God says when he was 75 years old, he's going to have a son. When he was 99, after all those years of waiting, all those years of nothing, all those years of barrenness, Abraham's son was born. If God said it, He'll do it. The law tells you what God is like. By studying their laws, Israel would know what He was like. By keeping those laws, they would show what He's like. That, incidentally, is why David says, "Oh, how I love your law." Generally, we don't get too excited about the idea of rules, do we? Except when we want to break them. Do you love the law? The law is very exciting because, first of all, it tells you what God is really like. Second, it tells you what you're going to become like. And the righteousness of the law, according to Romans 8, is fulfilled in those who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. And one of the results of being a Spirit-filled Christian is this: you will live according to the law, and you'll live it out in all its righteousness. And you will love righteousness, and you will hate sin and distortion. So they had rules. What else did they have? Religion. And it was a fairly involved religion. They had all kinds of sacrifices. Suppose you had lived then, and you had born to the old cow a beautiful, flawless, little white calf in those days when they lived in the desert. And you were 7 years old, and this beautiful little white calf was born. You couldn't believe it when your dad said, "Okay, that calf is your responsibility." Realize there wasn't much excitement in the desert, and the birth of a calf was pretty big news. And so he says, "That's your responsibility. You look after that calf, make sure it gets plenty of water, plenty of food, not left out in the sun, tethered at night so it doesn't get lost. Your job." And you're all pleased with it, and you give your calf a name, and it learns to come when you call it. And you even keep it nice and clean and brushed because there's not much else to do. And you build up a real close relationship with the calf because you get on better with the calves than you do with your mum and dad. Until one day your dad comes home looking very, very serious, and he says to you, "Put a rope on the calf." And you say, "Why? Where are we going?" "Church." "Church? My calf doesn't go to church. I haven't taught it any songs yet. It certainly doesn't know how to pray. It might misbehave in front of the priest. That would be terrible." And then you see your dad's looking very, very serious. So you stop talking, you get a rope, put it on the calf, and the two of you go to the tabernacle. And you tie the calf to the corner of the tabernacle, of the altar. And the priest comes out looking rather formidable with his huge flowing robes and this big gold crown on his head saying, "Holiness to the Lord." And he looks very severe. And your dad looks the priest in the eye and puts his hand on the head of your calf. And he tells the priest he stole something that day. And the priest looks very serious and your dad looks very upset. And then the priest takes a sharp knife and slits the throat of your calf. The blood spurts out of the neck arteries and he catches it in the basin. And he looks at your dad and he sprinkles him with the blood. And he says, "God has accepted the life of the calf in payment for his life. And that he is forgiven and he can go free." And you see new hope come to your dad and his shoulders square and his head rises again and smile back on his face. And together you turn around, you leave the dead body of your calf there and you walk away. And you've learned a whole lot about God. You've learned that he sees personal sin and he regards it as being serious. You've learned that he's a God of justice and sin has to be paid for. You've also learned that he's God of mercy and he wants man to know that he can be forgiven. And there is a way of forgiveness, but it's not cheap. As you leave, you might say, "Well, Dad, you know, I understood all that. I'll never forget it. I realize how serious sin is. But Dad, why did it have to be my calf? Why couldn't it have been the old cow? She's sick and she's going to die anyway." And your dad explains how only that which is perfect is acceptable with God, flawless.